Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside scoop on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com or the Heritage Radio Network. And, of course, you can always download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hi, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Feisty.
I can feel it. I can feel it. It's crazy. Hey, listen, I want to ask everybody out there to if you like our podcast, to email it to 10 friends. We're on a membership drive. It's like public radio, except we're not even asking you for any money. I just want more listeners. I want to spread the word and say, hey, you got to subscribe to their podcast on iTunes or check us out on Heritage Radio.
What a great idea.
I think it's terrific. Want to talk about, we're going to talk with Steve Olson later. You may not know Steve Olson, but he is a tremendous guy in the beverage world. I've known him for a long time, and this first time he's going to be on the show. I was excited about that. And I thought we'd start the show with a fun fact about beverage. And in the category of every once in a while we'll do shows where the category overall is bad ideas. And I think this one falls squarely in there. I want to know what you all think about it in listener land. Please do email me, francis@restaurantguysradio.com. Tell me if you've experienced this or seen it at a liquor store or you have any strong ideas on it. But this is it's called Scotch in a Can. And recently read about this. I think we found out about it on Tasting Table. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't Tasting Table. It was something else. But Scotch in a Can. Attention, fans of boxed wines. Our new item on the market now is Scotch in a can. That's right. Looks like a beer can, except it is 12 ounces of Scotch.
All right. I'm going to say first pass here, Scotch in a can, maybe not a terrible idea, more portable, not breakable.
Teeny tiny little can?
Teeny tiny little can. See, what I'm thinking is, you know, those little tomato juice cans or something like that that are like
little half the 3 size
ounces.
Of that would be a little...
They're like 3 ounces, 4 ounces, something like that. 12 ounces of Scotch
in an unresealable container. Here you go, kiddies.
Right. I pulled the tab. Got to go for it now.
Got to drink a half a bottle of
it's
Scotch
like
now.
It's like some bad scene out of Animal House.
It's
is really what it is.
Right. It would be a joke if it were in a movie. You would laugh at it.
Right.
Okay. For a mere $5, drinkers may soon be able to open up a can and chug 12 ounces of whiskey. I'll attribute this article at the end of the segment. Scotch in a can boasts an exceptional blend, this is a quote, of Scottish spirits is the name of the company, Orlando, based in Florida. Go to Disney, have some Scotch in a can. Scotch in a can boasts an exceptional blend of the finest malt and grain Scotch whiskies.
I don't think so.
Well, and malt and grain Scotch?
I'm going to go with no. I'm going to go with no. Okay.
It's amber in color. And is rich in honey, vanilla, butterscotch, apples, and pear notes with a nice hint of peat and smoke in the background.
It sounds so good.
Okay, it's ridiculous. Now, here is the company. Here's the line from the company. A lot of people like to have beverages by their pool, on their boat, in a campground, at a sporting event, or in a tailgate party.
I agree. I want you to know something. I have had beverages... at all of those places.
Rarely Scotch, and they want to change that.
You know, I've even had Scotch at some of those places.
Yeah, yeah.
And I untwist the cap of the bottle,
yeah.
And I pour a little, and then I put the cap back on, and I put it away, and then the next guy has some.
Well, here's the deal. Or not, or you bring it up.
Yeah.
It's easier to bring a six-pack of a beverage versus bringing a bottle of Scotch. Hold on, rewind. Six-pack of cans. 12 ounces of Scotch. You better have a lot of people at your party. A six-pack, five, and first of all, the price is irresponsibly low. A can says single serving is what it says is single serving.
A can says single serving. You cannot reseal it. Okay, so either, you know, you're all sipping off the same can, and that has, you know, I just think about sitting around a circle, you know, passing a,
okay,
little cigarette around the. That's, you know, that's
because the only person I share my can of beverage with is my girlfriend, and a girl that I want to be with.
All right, new marketing idea.
What?
I just came to me this second. Okay, it's a Scotch in a can, right? but it's got six different pull tabs on the top of the can.
Oh, a sectionized can.
So you can work your way around the can as you go.
Your scotch should be a little more difficult. Honestly, really. It deserves a little more respect than that. Right, let me read on.
Come on, I'm a genius.
The liquor.
I didn't get any credit for the Acme. We're gonna call it Acme soda in a can.
It's better.
Because there's an anvil waiting to hit you in the head.
No, you know what they should have is oh, I love this. They should have
that. You didn't hold on. Stop. You did not give me enough credit for Acme soda in a can.
No, that was a little Roadrunner. That was good. I liked it. I get it. I should have laughed a little more. But hold on. You ready? You take your sectioned can idea, right? So you have six sections in your 12-ounce can, mm-hmm. and you pull, or you only have three tabs though, because every other section is soda. So well, you have like, a scotch and soda in like, a can that mixes in your mouth. How amazing is that?
Okay, ready?
Yeah.
Or every other one is empty. And it's like Russian roulette of scotch. It's a drinking game. It's a can of scotch. Come on. It's got it all going on.
Here we'll go on with a little more of this. The liquor may boast 3 years of aging in the Highlands of Scotland. You can't really boast about 3 years of aging. I'm very big. I'm boasting. 3 years? I'd like the three-year-old scotch, please.
You know, I don't recall ever hearing somebody order the three-year-old scotch.
You see, now bourbon can be 3 years old. Rum at 3 years old is great. Scotch at 3 years old?
Wah, wah, wah.
You know, it's like it reminds me of Steve Martin in The Jerk, where he comes over and says, "Waiter, do you have any new wine? All this
wine is
old."
Yeah, exactly. Same.
Okay, so the guy from the company recommends, says that consumers will savor and not chug the cans.
Huh?
What? What are you, ridiculous? And he recommends using it as a mixer. Of course, there's no way to close the can up again. You still got to make then six mixed drinks out of every can.
Why
divisible
not?
By six. You can't. If you make eight mixed drinks, you're back in the same amount of trouble.
Why
as
Why not
before.
Just make a smaller twist off bottle, and make it plastic? Even.
Yeah, they have those because they already have those. Because somebody already did that. Here's the deal. It's not only just that you would have to make six drinks. Maybe there are seven of you. Well, then you have the same problem again. You've got to make the drink six at a time or throw some of the scotch away. And here's what he says. We want people to be responsible. This is 12 fluid ounces of scotch, and people should treat it as such. And so should you, and not put it in a goddamn can, is all I have to say. We'll be back in a moment to talk about much more serious and much more fun and much more delicious ways to drink many sorts of spirits with Steve Olson. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is an old friend, first time on the show, Steve Olson. He is a wine and spirits professional. He teaches, lectures, and writes all over the world about wine, beer, spirits, sake, cocktails, and everything under the sun. He has his own company called AKA Wine Geek, and you will find him just about everywhere in cocktail and beverage circles.
Hey, Steve. Great to finally have you on the show, man.
Thank you. It's great to be here, but I'm not sure how I'm supposed to live up to that introduction.
I think you already have.
Yeah,
Steve.
That's what you've done in the past. Yeah. Living up to it would be what you do next.
It's all down from here, brother. That's all you
got. What am I going to do next?
I don't know, but you always do surprise me.
Oh, well, thank you. I live my life for that very purpose, to surprise you.
I thought you were going to say loaded. I really...
That's the other side. You know. Many people think that I drink for a living, which is basically the truth. I do. Of course, responsibly, as we know, we have to do that. But I do have the greatest life in the world, in my opinion. For what I like to do, I love my life.
I like to tell people I drink smartly.
I teach others to drink smartly. Before you came on the show, Steve, maybe we could get your valued opinion on something we mocked it a little bit. Have you seen that the new whiskey available in the 12-ounce pull-tab can?
Oh, please. Do we have to go there?
It made for some funny mocking fodder, but I think that ranks up with one of the worst ideas of all time.
Yeah, you know, here we are, you know, some old restaurateur guys who've been doing this our lives, and we look at something like that and think it might be a bad idea, and just watch. That will be the product launch that revolutionizes our industry, and we'll be sitting there going, how did we miss it?
You know what? I think it's going to make – I really do think it's going to make somebody rich, and it's also going to make somebody drive into a wall.
Well, I think that is the key. And, you know, you talk about drinking smartly and responsibly, and that's what scares me about something like this. It brings it – it makes it too easy. It makes it too accessible. You know, alcohol is served the way it is for a very specific reason, because if it's not treated with respect, it can be very dangerous. And as much as we joke about how much we love our jobs and how much we love to drink, and we do that with responsibility. And unfortunately, I think I can speak for all of us here, that we were lucky enough to learn at an early enough age that if we wanted to continue doing this for our entire lives, we were going to have to understand our body.
Mm-hmm.
Understand the effects of alcohol, understand how we can moderate our consumption. I mean, I remember very clearly as a young man working in a restaurant, the first wine list I ever wrote, and I had a mentor, a head waiter who I respected. I thought he was amazing. I learned so much from him about service and about being warm and friendly and kind to people. And I'll never forget the night that I finally, in my naivete at the ripe old age of 19 years old, and I had just written my first wine list, you know, and I was so proud, and I'm working with this great team, and it finally sunk in the reason that this guy had these mood swings and the reason he was the way he was. I said, he was an alcoholic, and I didn't know that, and I didn't understand that, and the reason that he couldn't drink, you know, it never made sense to any of us. We why wouldn't you drink with us? And so one night he did, and we realized that. And I was lucky enough, I was sad for him, but lucky enough myself to see that and say, whoa, hang on a second, this stuff is dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got to be careful, because I knew even then that I wanted to do this for the rest of my life.
Right.
And I realized that I had to take very clear, definitive action about my consumption for the rest of my life. And I think, I have to agree with you, Mark, I think that this is a frightening thing when you make it too easy for young people to drink.
Well, Or people of any age. I mean, a 12-ounce can of vodka, it is not a resealable container.
Right, of
whiskey. We know that people like to finish things, and they don't like to leave. You know, you're not going to throw it. People are loathe to throw it into the ground or flush it down the toilet.
I mean, there are studies out there with M&Ms where if there's one bowl of M&Ms that's full and one bowl of M&Ms that's empty, the full bowl, people will eat more M&Ms out of the full bowl.
Than the half-empty one, yeah.
I mean...
Well, now, interestingly enough, on your point of the, you know, aluminum can kind of thing, now, I have seen something recently that I think it hasn't gotten any traction as of yet, but I see it as being a very, very bright idea that I think can work. And I've seen this. Have you seen these little wine, aluminum wine bottles? They're like a soda bottle or like, you know, one of these... you know, beer equivalent cocktail things, but they have a screw cap.
Yeah, and they're
so they reseal. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a very interesting idea, because you start thinking about, you know, picnics, you know, when you're hiking, if you're at the pool in a hotel kind of environment, you know, you can't bring glass containers, things of that nature. And when I first saw that, thought about that, and I thought about that as a booze container. You know, what if they did that with higher proof alcohol? And I went, oh my God. That's
right.
A nightmare. No. It's a frightening thing. People like, even if it reseals,
mm-hmm.
people have, it's a human nature to finish.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and if you make a 750-milliliter bottle, then your human nature is like, oh, I'm not going to finish that, you know. I mean, that's, but if you make it finishable, you know, if Häagen-Dazs ice cream came in half gallons, you might be able to eat a quarter of a pint and put it back.
Francis?
Yeah.
Now they make Häagen-Dazs ice cream in half gallons.
Okay, when you bring your Häagen-Dazs... I'm so old. I knew that, actually. But when you bring Häagen-Dazs ice cream home in a half gallon, you can have a small bowl of it and put it back. If you bring a pint container of Häagen-Dazs ice cream home, most people eat a pint of ice cream, and that's
which
it.
Which is ridiculous.
Right.
Your body can't even handle it, but
you
do it because it's there.
It's true. I think about that three nights a week. I go, this is ridiculous. Give me the rum raisin. So,
no, but you're absolutely right, and it is a very frightening thing. And, you know, not to spend that much more time on this, but it really scares me to think that... you know, a young person in particular, but anybody, that might mistakenly think that the manufacturer or the producer of this product had measured this out. Your metaphor is exactly correct, and you could pick anything like that. When you buy the small bag of potato chips, that's a single serving. But if you read the back and the nutritional things, it says, no, that's four servings.
Right.
Yeah,
you're supposed to split that up, you know. Now, if you go buy the big bag, you're as inclined to finish the big bag as you are the small bag because it's open and it's in front of you
right. And
it's got salt on it and it's delicious. Well, if you've got any kind of, you know, bodily function that makes you crave alcohol, which many people do and don't even know, that once you get past a certain point, your body just wants more and it isn't thinking anymore. Now the thing's open, you're going to finish it.
Yeah,
Let's face it, 12 ounces of whiskey?
You have a non-resealable container that will take you to twice the legal limit of being sober.
Yeah, easily.
I can't imagine that this is going to stay on the market long.
I hope not.
I can't imagine that it's not going to be, pulled off the shelves.
Let's take this to another. Now, we've been friends for a long time, and you do amazing work in cocktails, and you do cocktails all over the country, and we've done cocktail stuff in similar cities. And
I will share one. And I will share just a quick pat on the back here. One of my favorite people to listen to a lecture from.
Oh yeah, you're
just
awesome.
Always exciting and fun.
I take a lot of pride and pleasure, and coming from you, that means a lot to me. Really, really does. I mean, to me, I think the greatest gift that I have been blessed with, and that many of us are blessed with, is the ability to share, the ability to motivate and inspire, and I don't ever take that for granted or take it lightly. And the fact that, that is the thing I probably pride myself on the most is that, you know, guys like us spend our whole lives researching and digging and finding information and trying to learn. And then I think what makes our industry so special is that there is a natural penchant to share. To me, it's all about sharing that information with as many people as I can and trying to help people do it better in the future.
The thing is, learning
from our mistakes.
Even as far as sharing with the guest, Mark and I really view our job as restaurateurs, and as publicans, as bartenders, as mixologists, as sommeliers. And when we teach our staff this, the restaurant's staff, the waiter, the sommelier, yeah, it's to get you your food on time. But that's the same in a burger joint as it is in fine dining, and there may be a few more rituals that you go through. But really what you go to a restaurant like ours for, if it's in any way successful, and in any bars that you have consulted on or opened, our job is to contextualize. We don't grow the food. We don't cook the food. We don't make the spirits. We contextualize things. We explain it to people in an easy, fun, and digestible way, where if I say, here's a bottle of red, it's good. Drink it. It's $50. Well, that's not really bringing anything to your life. But, you know, here's this amazing bottle of red I found from this all but abandoned appellation in the northern Rhone Valley that's being brought back by one producer from old cuttings of vines they found, and here's how it relates to the rest of the Rhone Valley. Well, that's a special bottle of wine, you know, and that's our job in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah, that is exactly what we do. And you know, it's all about the stories. No, it starts with the quality, and it starts with the juice, and it starts with bringing something to the guest. But it's the story. It's
right.
The contextualizing. It's bringing it and making it fit within the environment for which it is being served and in which it's being served and for which it's chosen. You know, to me, one of the easiest mistakes that people make as young sommeliers or young beverage managers coming up is that they tend to think that, it's about them or it's about their list or, you know, the restaurant business itself is, it's a package deal. You know, people go out to eat, they go out to drink, but they go out to eat. And so the idea is choosing your beverages, whether it be cocktails or wine or beers or soft drinks, even non-alcohol teas, everything, sakes, choosing everything to fit within the environment of that restaurant and to work with the food, to complement the food, to make the chef's food taste even better than it would without those beverages. And I treat my beverages in my programs as condiments. To me, my wine and my cocktails and everything else that I choose for that restaurant, and I do the whole package or I don't do it at all, it's the salt and pepper, the lemon, the Worcestershire, the mustard, the ketchup, whatever you want to call it. It is the condiments that help make the food taste better and make the experience even more fun. it's not so much about the alcohol and getting a buzz as it is having this great warm experience that, as you said perfectly, it contextualizes everything. Everything has to fit. And it goes way beyond the beverage and the food. It's the way we talk to people. It's the way we treat them. It's the environment that we create. It's the ambiance that we create. It's when you go into a restaurant like yours and feel that, where everything works together because people are working together to make it that way, you don't have to worry about, you don't really feel that people are working to make it that way.
Yeah,
you feel that it works.
One of the things that you know, anybody in this business notices, and one of you notice early on in your career, is that wine tastes better when you're sitting in the middle of the vineyard, you know, from where it comes, and when you're at the place, and when you're in the middle of Italy, in the little, you know, village in Chianti, and you're sitting there tasting with the winemaker, you know, right where the grapes were grown. That's because you're sitting in the context. That's exactly what it is. And in the restaurant, we're trying to bring some of that to you in a new place, in a different place from where it was produced. But those stories help to bring you there.
Exactly. And we are trying to take you on a little journey.
And think about how boring it would be. Think if you wouldn't go back. You go to a restaurant, they have a great wine program. None of the wines have labels. I'll have a bottle of light red number one, and you don't even know the name of it. And then the next time you go back, you're like, yeah, they have good wine and beer, and it has no name and it has no story.
I mean, you do it.
It.
There are restaurants where you say, I'll have the Merlot, I'll have the Cabernet, I'll have the Chardonnay.
Yeah,
how you order your
nothing
wine.
Nothing special. Hey, I want to beleaguer one point that we talked about earlier, or actually relate it to a slightly different point, and I really would like your take on this, Steve. We were talking about contextualizing alcohol and treating it with a certain level of respect. You know, we had, of course, anybody who listens to this show knows, as we all do, we had a wonderful cocktail culture in America. The biggest enemy to cocktail culture was, of course, the Prohibition and Depression and war. And when we came back, our cocktail culture had lost a lot of its richness, and it was the rise of vodka and the rise of mediocre vodka and vodka in fruit juice and vodka in and simple flavors. And then as the cocktail renaissance, I would say, you know, the bartender shot heard around the world was Dale DeGroff, probably at the Rainbow Room in the 90s.
Absolutely.
And what I look upon is those simple vodka juices with vodka in them, and is that it was drinking for people who didn't like alcohol and never developed a taste for alcohol. And I look at some of the products on the market today, and I think they're a little juvenile, I'll be honest with you. So let's look at, I saw a bubblegum-flavored vodka recently.
Oh, please.
And I thought, you know, if you don't like drinking alcohol, then don't drink alcohol.
Or if you like bubblegum, have bubblegum.
Right. You know, and
well, I don't know. I try to keep an open mind and think, you know, there's got to be something for everybody. That might be pushing it a little bit, but let's face it. I mean, the latest trend in vodka has gone towards, you know, cupcake, whipping cream, all these sweet dessert type flavors that, you know, those of us who make cocktails kind of marvel at, because isn't that our job?
Well,
aren't we supposed to make cocktails that taste like that?
But also, even in cocktails, if you look at, like, and if the cocktail heard around the world was the Cosmopolitan, of course.
Of course.
And if you look at what was different about that than the Harvey Wallbangers or the Fuzzy Wuzzy Woo-Woos or whatever was popular before that, that was a drink that certainly was vodka-based. It was based when Dale sort of codified the recipe. It was Absolute Citron, Cointreau, and a little bit of cranberry juice and lime juice. But you could taste that it was a cocktail. And I just think that we go into an odd area with, like, alcoholic iced tea, for example, where I think that it's dangerous almost when you are drinking but masking the taste of alcohol.
Well, it's alcohol as a drug as opposed to alcohol.
Yeah, it's just a delivery system for alcohol that doesn't taste like alcohol.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's a delivery system, and that's where I think those of us who really care about this stuff, we get really scared. That's where we like to draw the line and say, come on, man. You're supposed to – there's so much romance. There's so many great stories. There's so many wonderfully handcrafted, beautifully distilled spirits. There's so many great mixologists in the country today making the handcrafted cocktails from those spirits. They're all these beautiful wines. Why do we need to have these lesser products that are literally delivery systems for a very dangerous drug.
Well,
I mean, honestly, when you look at the way the laws are set up in this country, it's kind of startling, because you think about how dangerous alcohol can be, and yet it's legal.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go any further with that
yeah.
one. But, you know, I don't think alcohol should be illegal either. I think you were absolutely correct. Prohibition was probably the single worst time in our history, and look at what it caused, and look at the laws that are in place as a result of that debacle. But the fact of the matter is, there should be some sort of dividing line. There's got to be some way that we can make it clear to people that this one may not be the right one for, you know, especially young people coming up. Because honestly, that's the most frightening thing of all. We talk about cigarette advertising being geared towards kids. Have you seen any of the alcohol ads lately?
Yeah, it's
Come
crazy.
On, man. It's all crazy. Geared towards, you know, teenagers that are going to be legal soon, that are drinking illegal probably if they can get their hands on it, that as time goes on, they're going to grow into those products. And it's like, oh, my God.
Well, let's talk about...
We're making it too easy for them.
Let's talk about something that's a little more of an adult spirit, something that I know that you're really passionate about. I think that mezcal and tequila and mezcal overall, you're probably the preeminent American ambassador for that category of topic. And our mutual friend Don, who brings in those wonderful Del Maguey tequilas, which we've carried since they first became available in the country, sort of opened my eyes to mezcal outside of tequila.
Yeah, Ron has done some really impressive things.
Yeah,
he really
so
is. He's
so
an amazing guy
but,
too.
So if he opened our eyes to mezcal outside of tequila, and then you've really run with this.
I was involved in the tequila field. I was a fanatic. You know, many years ago, I worked in Arizona for a dozen years. And I opened a couple of great restaurants out there and got a chance to work with some really wonderful chefs. And being, you know, in that proximity to Mexico, I had access to all these agave spirits. Even though they weren't really coming into the country, I was going down there and finding them and tasting them. And I'll never forget, in 1989, I opened a restaurant called Christopher's with Christopher Gross, who's one of the great chefs in our country. And we had a tequila list. In 89, and everyone
wow.
thought we were absolutely insane. Now, I mean, understand, we're doing handcrafted beers, which was a brand new novelty in the United States, and we're doing handcrafted cocktails with fresh ingredients. We're using all fresh juices. We're using a premium well, which people thought we were insane. And we had 100 wines by the glass, and people thought that was pretty insane in those days, too.
But you were a nut.
We were a nut. We were a pair of crazies is what we were.
Okay.
Look, you know what we did? When we created that restaurant, we decided. I mean, it was my belief, and I'd been doing this. I worked at the Point Resorts for 7 years, running their flagship restaurant up there, and my belief was that the restaurant business was about common sense, and I still work this way, that I tried to think of what I would want as a customer walking into a restaurant, and even though it, you know, I if I hear it one more time again in my life, it'll be, you know, in the billions now. But, I mean, how many times do you guys hear, well, that'll never, you know, you guys are doing really cool stuff at your place.
Oh, my God.
But
I hear it all the time.
Never work in my place.
Yeah.
My customers don't want that. It's really neat that your customers do that, and it works for you, but it could never work in my... I mean, I've been hearing that my whole life. And,
yeah.
You know, it's part of what motivated me to do what I do for a living now, which is the teaching and the training and all of the consulting work that we do. It is really totally what motivated me, because, and it's what motivated me to open with Christopher, is that, you know, I'm working in a corporate environment, and while they were very open-minded and allowed me to do a lot of really crazy things up there, I still had to sell everything to the corporation. I had to convince them that this was the right thing to do. I had to prove it, test it. And I was like, you know, after 7 years, and I thank that company for giving me the opportunities that they did, and for teaching me and giving me a chance to learn and grow. But I was ready. And when we opened our place, my thought was, everybody in Phoenix needs this. They want this. They just don't know that they can have it yet.
Right. They don't know it exists.
Nobody's ever brought
right.
it. Yeah. And so that was the program we created. And we had a tequila list there. And my customers, you know, we had a bistro out front, which is very casual, and people would come and sit at the wine bar and experiment and all of that. But in the formal dining room, where Christopher was doing Relais Chateau Michelin-starred food, 60 seats, beautiful. You know, people would, what do you mean, tequila? You must be crazy. So I used to, I mean, now I'm revealing my secrets, but I would bring a snifter after dinner,
mm-hmm.
and place that thing down in front of somebody, and they'd be, oh, my God, that is absolutely beautiful cognac. And I'd say, you know, I love cognac, too.
Right.
I do.
Right.
I'm a big cognac fan, as you guys know. But I said, that's not cognac. That's tequila.
Yeah.
What? No, you know, because in those days, tequila was all about frat parties, and it was about margaritas made in trash cans, and it was about, you know, worshiping the porcelain goddess. And the fact that there were these artisanal, handcrafted, beautiful spirits made in Mexico that were an art form that had been being made for, in the case of tequila, you know, at least 100 or more years, and in the case of these mezcals that I was finding, 300 or 400 or maybe 500 or 600 years old. I mean, as you guys know, I'm completely convinced now that the Native Americans were distilling before the Spanish even got
yes,
here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's no question the Spanish brought the Olympic still, but I'm convinced that they had discovered their own version of distillation long before the Spanish arrived, and that they were making mezcal-like products then that have evolved into what they are today. But in those days, I used to introduce people to tequila, so I was very involved in this thing for a long time, and I tasted in Mexico products like Sotol, products like Bacanora, other types of mezcals from other states. And when Ron Cooper showed up in the United States with the Del Maguey Single Village mezcals in the mid to late 90s,
I remember.
You know, I tasted one, as you guys did,
yep.
and I went out of my mind.
Yeah.
And I was with a very close friend of mine, Jimmy Yeager, who runs a fabulous American bar and restaurant in Aspen called Jimmy's, and he just opened. He was open, you know, he had been at the Caribou Club, and he'd been open now for about a year, maybe not even that long, when we tasted these together. And, you know, I tasted them first out here, and he tasted them out there, and we talked, and it was like, what is this stuff? So we just took it upon ourselves to look into it, and we found Ron Cooper. And I was judging a margarita competition, of all things, in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Well, it turns out Ron was based in Taos, so he drove down to meet us.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy flew in, and that was it. We spent the day with him. We spent the evening with him. We talked with him, and Jimmy and my wife, Melissa, and I went to Oaxaca in search of these little villages and in search of these Native American Zapotec producers. Ron hooked us up. He wasn't even there at the time. He hooked us up with his, you know, the guy, the Zapotec that he works with, that, you know, is, you know, overseeing the production in the villages. And off we went looking for these, and I was hooked. And that was in 1998. And ever since then, it has been my personal mission to not to convince anybody of anything, but rather just to share this unbelievable heritage and culture that exists amongst the natives in Mexico, and quite frankly, you know, Oaxaca is the birthplace, and it's the home for most of the great mezcal being made in Mexico. But there are mezcals of some sort or another being made in almost every state in Mexico.
Yeah, I one of the things that really intrigued me when I tasted all those mezcals, and Ron Cooper was the guy for me as well. When I tasted them, what was so great about it wasn't even necessarily that there was this super high-quality mezcal coming out. What was really intriguing to me was that Ron took each of these different villages
yeah.
and bottled them separately
yes.
and let each of the different characteristics come out, and how different the Chiquicapa was from the Minero to the
exactly.
you know, San Luis del Rio.
It was, and that to me was the eye-opener.
That was the revelation. Literally, it was 1985, and I was standing for the first time right in between the DRC and La Tosh. You know, there I was tasting terroir in a glass, in spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd experienced that in Scotland, and I'd experienced that to a certain degree within the different regulated areas of cognac. I'd experienced that somewhat in spirits in tequila, because I'd spent some time in Jalisco and in the valley versus up in the higher areas. But never had I experienced it like that, where I tasted the Santo Domingo Alvarados, for example, you know, which has grown up at over 9,000 feet above sea level. And then I tasted, you mentioned the Monero, which is made in, you know, a ceramic still at only 7,000 feet above sea
level. Right,
right. And that 2,000-foot difference, just the remarkable difference in acidity, in the way that the earth spoke through those products. And it was as if these producers, you know, they all had their own little way of doing it, but basically they're making it in a very similar fashion. It's the agave speaking.
You can find videos online of how they make this, and you will be amazed that a spirit that's available in the United States is still made this way.
Well, as a matter of fact, on my website, we have footage of some of the work that we've done down there with some of these small Zapotec producers, that it's absolutely mind-blowing.
There's also a great old show we did with Ron Cooper, I'm going to say 4, 5, 6 years ago, early on, that you can find searching the archives of Restaurant Guys Radio.
Yeah.
I can't wait to listen to that one. I'm sorry I missed that. Ron is such a character, as you guys know. I mean, not only is he one of the most respected artists in the world today, but not for his work with Mezcal, for his actual art. You know, he's a sculptor. He's an incredible artist. And he saw what these Native Americans were doing as art.
Yeah.
And said, I need to share this with the rest of the world. I need to bring this to the American public and show them this amazing artwork that's been being done for centuries. And I remember clearly the very first time I was there, that was the only thing they cared about. They just wanted me to understand that it had been handed down from generation to generation to generation to generation, and that the true art form was in embracing the history and the heritage and capturing the nature of the plant, because it's really all about the agave.
You know,
amazing.
The first time that I met, we had been carrying the spirits for quite a while, well, for a couple of years, when I met Ron at Dale DeGroff's birthday party at the Belmont Racetrack, and we were screaming at a horse, like waving our tickets.
I was there!
And I was like,
remember I brought Dale a bottle of Pachuca
for
his birthday?
Yeah, I do recall, and I thought, wow, this is the guy, huh?
That's the guy.
And he had a winner.
Probably a Mexican horse.
Before I bring, you know what, we need to take a quick break, because this Mezcal production that you talk about is really facing a pretty significant threat right now, and there's something that you out there in listener land can do about it to get involved, and it's really something you need to be aware of, and it's an issue that rises above Mezcal and spirits production overall. It's a very human issue. So stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis. We're talking with our friend Steve Olson about all things tequila, and I want to go to a very serious issue, a very, very current issue, where if you care at all about artisanal products of any sort, even if you don't drink, there's an issue that you want to talk about. But I have to bring the conversation down into the because I've been thinking about something since it happened.
What you have to realize is if you're in a room with me, Francis, and Steve, it's very hard to talk about something serious.
Or at least to stay on track. We all talk like bartenders, you know?
We have so much to talk about.
Yeah, I know, my God. All right, so here's what I was thinking. I envisioned you back in your dining room in 1988, and you bring over the snifter of something, and you place it down in front of the guy, and the guy says, "That's the best cognac I've ever had." And you say, "But, sir, it's not cognac. It's tequila!" And I thought about, like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and, like, everybody came out of the back. That would be the great commercial for it. You should have kept a couple of mariachi guys there just for that.
little thing. Okay, there's a joke that fell flat on the Restaurant Guys.
They can't all be great. Hey, sorry,
you know,
folks.
I never did it to deceive them. I did it only to open their horizons.
I know, but you could have had a Folgers moment there. I mean, yeah, it would have been... Fair. All right, so let's talk about this very serious issue that's going on in Mexico right now. It's a big guys against little guys fight. What's happening, Steve?
Well, it's very complicated, but I guess to just... In a nutshell, basically, people are misunderstanding that, you know, perhaps some of the small producers in tequila might be affected or that Ron's individual producers might be affected. They're actually the ones that are working hard to make sure it doesn't happen, not because they're affected, but because they're worried about the culture in general. What's happened basically is that there's a movement afoot, funded by some of the largest producers that will change the way bottles are labeled, change the way we can use the word agave, change the way we can use the word mezcal and tequila. And it's a very complicated, but if I could put it this way, currently there are, you know, tequila started because it was made in the town of Tequila in the state of Jalisco.
So it's a type of mezcal that is made in tequila in Jalisco.
Right. Well,
but it's all mezcal.
Originally, it was all mezcal. And as you know, we taught it that way right up until a couple of years ago because... tequila is to mezcal as cognac is to brandy, shall we say. You know, that tequila is a very specific type of
mezcal. It's a subset.
A specific place. It's all about place. But today, that's not necessarily true. First of all, tequila has its own denomination of origin and can be made now in 5 different states. So the idea of it being from Tequila and from Jalisco has kind of spread out. It's 5 different states. Now, as such, then mezcal kind of, if you will, retaliated, and mezcal as a word needed respect because mezcal was getting a bad rap, and mezcal was considered, you know, the stepchild to tequila, which in actuality it is the earth mother to tequila. Mezcal's where it all began. So mezcal got together and created a DO. So now there are 7 states that are allowed to make a product called mezcal. Now, in addition, there is Sotol, which is made in Chihuahua, and then there's Bacanora, which is made in Sonora. So now I have these controls. Well, what's happened is some of the politicians and some of the companies are saying, well, Bacanora, Sotol, Mezcal, and Tequila are the only words that are allowed to be used, and since we all have DOs, these are the only DOs that are going to be allowed. And from this point forward, all of the other states, all of the other producers, all of the other small entities that are making any type of mezcal anywhere in Mexico, and believe me, there are many of them. It's a culture and a heritage and a history that dates back, most of us believe, as early as the Mayan civilization, but certainly before Christ, and has evolved through centuries and centuries and centuries. But there's no question that the agave plant and the fruits of the agave, and pulque in particular, date back at least a couple thousand years. Anyway, the bottom line is that these small producers, and all Native American, that are making some form of what we would have formerly have called mezcal until these rules were passed, will not only no longer be able to call their product mezcal, they're going to have to call it something to the effect of aguardiente de agave, which is going to mess up everybody. But not only that, but as part of this legislation being passed, they're sliding through these other rules that will help the big companies. For example, right now, you can't say it's 100% agave unless it is. Well, they're going to take that off, so now you can just say it's agave, but only if you're in tequila or mezcal. The other people can't do that. So that means that you can use a percentage, depending on the state, of other sugars. So it's not just made from the agave anymore. It could be made from sugarcane. It could be made from corn.
Cheaper sugars. The answer is cheaper sugars because agave is one of the most expensive sugars you can.
And it's very difficult, as you know. Mm-hmm. It takes 6, 8, 10, 12, 15. Some agaves take 30 years to ripen, certain types of agave that are being made into mezcals currently, right now in Mexico. So not only will it change the legislation completely to benefit only the largest producers, but it will also make it so that it's illegal for the small producers to even make a product that they've been making in many cases for hundreds of years.
That's crazy.
And it will make it so that the larger producers can change the way they label. So from now on, for example, and I'm not going to use any names, but your favorite tequila, the next time you taste it, might be 50% agave sugar, and 51%, and 49% cane sugar, and they don't have to tell you anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I mean, there are a number of smaller and yet even more devastating parts of this legislation that are being slid through. You know, it's like any form of politics we see in our country all the time. Well, I'll pass this, but you're going to have to give me this, and I want this part of the rule, but you can't have that. So they're negotiating right now, and the way this new legislation has been put on the table for a vote includes some of the most scandalous legislation in, honestly, it's not just about Mexico. You know my passion for mezcal and tequila and all of these products, and you know how I've worked for, you know, more than a decade to really educate Americans about, you know, the dangers of what we're doing to the agave, but also, you know, the pride and the cultural heritage of these Native Americans that make this great product. You guys have been there with me. You've been teaching it with me. We've done seminars together. You know how I feel about this. But I believe, and the reason that I was involved in this huge email campaign and this petition and so forth, is that this isn't just about Mexico anymore. This could set a precedent that could change artisanal distillation the way we know it throughout the globe.
Yep.
Because if this is allowed to happen in a place where, you know, the small artisan producers are vastly outnumber, they outnumber by far the large producers, if that can happen there.
Right, where distillation is a part of every or many villages, it's forever. It's always been there.
Been like that.
And so if these guys can get wiped out, then that's a terrible precedent for the world. But how do we, as non-Mexican citizens, how do people get involved? How do we try and make a difference as best we can?
Well, now you'd think that I would have this all ready for you here, and I sent out a number of emails, and I'm going to give you in just a second.
We're going to put it up on restaurantguysradio.com anyway. Steve sent out a petition that both Francis and I have signed already.
And sent out to our mailing list.
And sent out to our mailing list, and we're going to put it up on restaurantguysradio.com where you can be against this legislation and you can stand up against
it. If you click onto the Steve Olson Show, just go for the description. There's a little thing there that says links. Just click on links, and the link to this petition will be there, and it's a way to make your voice heard. And look, you are the consumers, and what they need to hear now is that the consumers of these liquors, the consumers of these products, don't want this change to happen. It's devastating to these small producers. It's disrespectful of the history of Mexico. But and to you and me and the people who we serve, it's not truth in advertising. It's misleading advertising.
Well, and you can hear, I have in front of me, just so I can say it on air, in case you don't want to go find it, so that you have no excuses, people. No, seriously, this is a very, very, very serious issue, and I really appreciate you guys taking the time to talk about this, because as you were involved and I was involved, I mean, there are many, many, many people that were very involved in this and helping to make this thing happen. It's not just us. I mean, the entire industry stepped up, and people from all over the world have signed this. It's called the Tequila Interchange Project, which is TIPS, which is something started by a group of very concerned agave aficionados in the United States, headed up by David Suro, who is, you know, a good friend of all of ours. David Suro's group, Tequila Interchange Project, which is TIPS, and if you go onto their website, www.tequilainterchangeproject.com/stop-NOM, N-O-M, that's what we call a norma in Mexico, stop NOM 186.
Well, there you have it. And if you're driving in your car, again, you can just go to our website and we'll click on the link. We'll have it there for you. So, Steve, I'm glad we got to talk about some fun stuff, and I'm glad we got to talk about some important stuff where people can actually take action.
Me too. I mean, this is something that's very close, very near and dear to our hearts, and hopefully we can get something done about it. This could be one of those wonderful social moments where the entire world says, no, you're just not going to get away with that. And, you know, one of my friends from Mexico suggested that, you know, we go to the UN and this and that. And I said, you know what? I agree with you 1,000%, but this area has already been granted the United Nations decree I mean, this is considered, you know, one
it's a UNESCO heritage site.
It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Yeah.
It's like, what more can be done to protect this? That we're, right now, we are, look, let me put this to you. The United States is responsible for nearly 70% of the tequila and mezcal being produced in Mexico. We import that much of it. We are the consumers that are driving this industry. We are the ones that have to help them. We have to protect them from themselves. You know,
well, and we have to protect the little guys there from the big guys.
We're not really protecting them from themselves. We're protecting, exactly, the small producers from the big producers.
I mean, there's no question that a lot of the international money that's gone in there in the tequila industry is behind this, but it's also some of the large Mexican companies that are just taking advantage of the people who have no voice. And it's up to people like us who can make a difference, who can step up, who can say, no, you're not going to get away with that. This is world heritage. This is culture. This is history that we cannot, we can't look away.
And everybody,
it's too important to all of our future.
And everybody I know in the beverage industry has gotten an email from somebody or other and signed this petition. I mean, literally everybody I know in the beverage industry has signed this petition, and it's concerned consumers. And if you're in the beverage industry, not only sign this petition, but then go on and forward it to someone else.
Forward
if you have a bar,
you know.
If you have a bar or a restaurant, I think it's okay to involve your consumers, your guests in this, because it shows them that we're all part of a community, and what you should be as the publican, as the bartender, as the restaurateur, is you should be a center of your community. You should be a locus for your community, and this is a great way to get involved in something that's not come to have the drink special on Thursday night.
Yeah.
And on that note, remember to come on Thursday night. We're having a drink special. Hey, Steve, it's been great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. It's always great to talk to you guys. I can't wait to see you at the next seminar.
Thanks, Steve.
We'll be there. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Love that dude, man.
I will tell you that.
High energy.
High energy. He is a great public speaker. He's somebody who, when I'm doing a lecture at Tales of the Cocktail or Manhattan Cocktail Classic or whatever.
You sneak out to see his lecture.
I always make sure that I see at least one of his, Dale's lectured. I always see Dale DeGroff. I always make sure I see one of something that he's doing. And I always make sure I see Steve Olson. They are the two people who I think that you can always learn something from. Their seminars are always a little bit different and exciting. And they're just fun to watch. They're fun speakers.
You know, I'll put a third up there, an all-time great beverage speakers of right now. That speak professionally. I'll throw two more up there. One guy who we don't see as often, he does wine more than he doesn't do cocktails as often, although he is an expert on cocktails as well, is Anthony Giglio. He's a
great
speaker. And he gave a talk for The Moth, which you'll be able to find on video in the spring, which is pretty cool. That's not on wine and spirits at all. Mm-hmm. And Tony Abuganim, our friend Tony.
He's another person I always search out.
You know?
Yeah.
Those are the
kings right now of lectures.
And Mark and Francis, of course.
Well, the people I go see. Those are the people I go see.
I usually watch myself on video. So I got a funny story about tequila. And
don't we all?
I have one that I remember. It's not about tequila, actually. It's about mezcal. And we should just clarify that I don't think we were clear. A lot of people know this, but agave is a plant. It's a cactus-like plant. And from agave, mezcal is made, if you consider mezcal the spirit. And the mezcal from designated districts is called either tequila or mezcal de Oaxaca. Or sotol, or whatever it is. But mezcal, that's the basic of it. So it was a bottle of mezcal, and Ron Cooper's mezcal that he brings in, the line of mezcals is Del Maguey, from different villages, some really crazy different things they do with mezcal. I sold a bottle to a friend. And when I go to Ireland, I always bring the mezcal because they don't have it there, and they're crazy about it. So I sold a bottle to an American guy who's a regular customer of ours, and he tells this story all the time. He's been telling it for like 10 years now. And he tells about how I sold him this bottle of mezcal, Ron Cooper's Del Maguey mezcal, and he brought it home, and he and his buddy basically drank the whole bottle. Or they drank three-quarters of the bottle, and they ate the worm. I said,
No, you didn't.
I said, I don't think he ate the worm. He's like, no, we ate the worm. And he was telling it in front of a group of people, so I couldn't really correct him, right? Customer's always right, you know what I mean? And he said, yeah, well, there was no worm in it when we were done. So he had gone all the way down the road with this crowd of people.
There is no worm in the bottle. It's a myth. There's no worm in the bottle. So
well,
you
it's
got,
not a myth. There used to be crappy
right, but you got,
mezcals on the market where you could but, where there'd be a worm in the bottle. And
well, but that was a marketing ploy.
Somebody
anyway.
Put a worm in the bottle after they made it.
But,
yes, yes.
But the, he ate the worm in the bottle, and I couldn't tell him. It's like, you know, you weren't so drunk you ate the worm in the bottle. You were so drunk you forgot there was never a worm in the bottle to begin with. That's what it was. But if I thought of that line, I might have been able. But I can't. But the thing. But it's fed on itself. He tells it every time he sees me, and I go, oh yeah.
Maybe you should write him a note.
Maybe you should show him a bottle. Someone.
Yeah, give him a new bottle.
Yeah,
there
exactly.
you go. Give him a new bottle. Here
He'll
you
probably
are.
Return it because somebody stole the worm. Well, I hope you guys have enjoyed this hour as much as we have. I'm going to have a freaking margarita.
That's a great idea.
All right. I'm Francis Schott.
I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network.